This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Somehow the team came together, from cinema photographer, director of photography Greg Fraser, all the way through to Villeneuve and the various different writers and stuff. I think it's just absolutely spectacular, one of my favourite films of the last few years. It's clear that a lot of the, at least the high level, you know, key players who are driving this project from a visual standpoint, from a writing standpoint, from a musical standpoint, really, really give a shit about this. And I think that shows so, so truly in what we got on the big screen and now on the little screen on Netflix.
Hey everyone, and welcome to this episode of Flixwater Podcast. Today I'm joined by Tim.
Hello.
Matt.
Hello.
Jack.
Hello.
And that's it. No! Helen's here as well, as always.
Hi.
And we're going to be talking about Dune. Not the first one, or the most recent one, the one in the middle. Thank you, as always, to Mighty People for their mighty tunes that you can hear right now, and thanks to Ben from Rockwood Audio for editing our podcast for us. Please do remember to head over to Spotify and Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and a glowing review. And please get in contact with us on Twitter at FlixWatcherPod, or get in contact with us on Instagram at FlixWatcher.
Hello, film fans. Joining FlixWatcher today, we have Jack, Matt and Tim. Over to you, please, Tim, to say hello to our listeners and tell them a little bit more about who you are and your podcast, please.
Hi, I'm Tim. I do a podcast called Sequelizers with Jack and Matt here that's about fixing the bad sequels to good films, although our remit has kind of expanded over the years as we've run out of bad sequels to good films. So now we do bad sequels to bad films and mediocre sequels to good films.
What would you say is the worst sequel ever?
Oh, man. I think probably Son of the Mask is a truly painful watching experience. I think our biggest drop is still Mulan to Mulan 2 in terms of Rotten Tomatoes ratings, which we look up on our show.
But a lot of those Disney films are just like, fuck it, let's just make something. And
straight to DVD bollocks, yeah.
Pumped out.
The kids will pester the parents to get by. They didn't give a flying shit, did they?
Not at all. And that really shows with Mulan.
S. Darko is also a pretty awful climb down from Donnie Darko.
Yes, yeah, we just did that recently. We've had a few really notable drops in terms of ratings. And then most things we tend to say kind of like 30 to 40% drop off on a Rotten Tomatoes rating is usually our sweet spot.
Yeah, I just find there's a few podcasts like yourselves which not necessarily delve into, not talking about sequels, but you kind of bathe in the bad films area. And myself and Helen a while ago said we try to encourage good films because we like talking about, we like looking forward to the films we're going to watch, right?
This is why we like being on this podcast. We get to talk about films we like. It's such a refreshing, nice thing to do.
We have a seasonal model where, so our seasons are dealing with the bad sequels, and then we have an inter-season period where we just talk about kind of general topics, and that really is, you know, it's our balm, because we can talk about films we actually like and enjoy rather than just slogging through the misery.
The real frustration is, as much as you get the dreck you have to sort of wade through, it's the frustration of saying, we're now going to describe a really good movie, and somehow they couldn't do it again. Yeah, seems to be the problem.
And before we go to obviously talking about Dune, which has got, by all esteems, a good sequel to it, and we would hope another good sequel coming soon. Jack, this is your choice, Dune. Can you tell us, first of all, why you chose it, and then the 60-second synopsis, if you can?
Oh, to preface my synopsis, I'm aiming for the FlixWatcher record of runtime to synopsis length here. That is my goal. I'm going super short. The reason I picked Dune, though, is because I read the book as a teenager, absolutely love it, and have read all of the Frank Herbert original series, not read the 20 Brian Herbert spin-offs. We won't talk about them, but... Yeah, absolutely love the book, grew up loving the book, and Denis Villeneuve is maybe my favourite director currently working. Like, he is a non-stop, all-hits, all-killer, no-filler kind of director for me. We did a live stream a couple of years ago now talking about Villeneuve's work, and we're basically just like, everything is great. Even the stuff you haven't seen, go and watch it. Everything, Sicario, Prisoners, Arrival, absolutely everything going through. I know you guys talked about Blade Runner 2049 not too long ago as well, like...
Yeah.
Just banger after banger after banger. And if it was like, we're sequelizing it, and I'm like, what director would I pick to do a Dune adaptation in the 2020s? It's fucking Villeneuve. Like, he would be the guy I would pick. And the casting is spectacular. The score from Zimmer is absolutely phenomenal. Like, I think it's just hitting on all cylinders and just absolutely phenomenal. And really resonated with me as a person who watched Lynch's Dune from 1984 many years ago and was like, I don't think this is the same as the book that I remember. I don't remember the voice thing being a literal like laser beam out of their mouths. That's a bit weird. But yeah, I think this is like one of the best. Oh, it's an unfilmable, unadaptable books taken to a film. And then obviously we're going to get part two. Fingers crossed for part three. We'll get a version of Dune Messiah. And every time I've kind of gone, oh, how are they going to do that? How are they going to do, no spoilers for Dune Part 2, how are they going to do a Leia? Because Lynch's version is weird, but it's quite accurate to the book. How do you do a psychic toddler type thing? It's like, they do something that's different, and I think it works. It's like, yeah, there's so much weirdness to the Dune world, to what Herbert created in the far, far future. I absolutely love, and I think somehow the team came together from cinema photographer, director of photography Greg Fraser, all the way through to Villeneuve and the various different writers and stuff. I think it's just absolutely spectacular and one of my favourite films of the last few years.
And just before we go into the film proper, has anyone seen, just yes or no, the miniseries? Because we talk about the David Lynch
Children
one,
of Dune.
Is it Children of
Dune? There's two.
James McAvoy.
Frank Herbert's Dune.
Dune and Children's Dune.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Now, I remember the sci-fi miniseries being advertised at the start of a... I can't remember what... it was like one of the first DVDs I owned, and it had the advert for it, and I can remember just watching it and being like, what is this? Why are their eyes blue? And not really knowing what was going on, but I haven't seen it.
Okay, fair enough, no worries. Okay, timer starts now.
Paul Atreides, as a possible chosen one of a centuries-long prophecy, is summoned to Arrakis, a distant and hostile planet that is the sole source of spice, a powerful chemical that is the key to space travel. On Arrakis, Paul and his mother Jessica must survive the destruction of their family and go on a journey, both physical and spiritual, to gain the trust of the Fremen, the native people of Arrakis, to gain desert power, in the words of Oscar Isaac, and fight back against the evil House Harkonnen.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Very nice.
There you go. 3-hour runtime in less than 30 seconds. That's how it's done.
Is this the first time anyone here has seen this film?
No.
Is this the first time... did everyone see it in the cinema the first time they saw this?
Yes. I didn't get to see it in the cinema, unfortunately.
What?
And I,
this is
I
Tim.
This really is Tim. Missed out. Yeah, but I remedied that for part two, thankfully.
We saw part two together, in fact, the three of us.
We did.
Oh, lovely.
Yes. It was a little
day out.
Trip.
Tim, what? I don't know. I don't know what to say.
What was I playing at?
Yeah. I know this was kind of pandemic times as well, and this kind of weird time to go into cinemas. But this was, I saw, you know, Tenet, and I think the next film I saw after that, post pandemic, was this one. And this was like, yeah, this is 100% a cinema film. But why did you miss it?
I think it was just a scheduling and a...
It was in the cinema for at least a year.
It is long,
though. It was all over the place. It was in like millions of screens, Tim.
We record a lot of sequelizers. Tim is busy a lot.
I have all these terrible films to watch. Means that I, you know...
Priorities, Tim, priorities.
I know. One of my sort of New Year's resolutions for this year was like, I've got to get to the cinema more. And I haven't really managed it yet. So I really regret, and if it gets, you know, a reissue, or hopefully we'll get a part three and maybe they'll put all of it back
part
in the cinema.
Part three marathon. Yes.
Yeah.
Take me back to my Lord of the Rings days.
Yeah. Then I, you know, if it's nearby and doable, then I will definitely make the effort to go see this in the cinema, because, yeah, the scale of these films is incredible, basically.
You're basically denying yourself something if you don't see it in a cinema. Although I will say, in defense, as someone who goes to the cinema obsessively, it's expensive. So there's also that.
Get your Cineworld Unlimited.
Yeah.
Get your membership and just, like, deal with... Then you've just got to twice a month to make sure you can...
Yeah. Like they then encourage you and like force you, like, I need to get my money's worth, so I need to go at least twice a month, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this was totally...
The trick there is bring your own food.
Well, I guess,
always. Yeah, of course.
This was definitely the film that dragged me out of the pandemic as well. Like, you, as you were saying there, Kobe, I think it was your second one after Tenet. This was my first, like, okay, I have to see Dune in the cinema. I will move heaven and earth and bin off whatever I need to bin off to make this work. And it was the first time. I'm not much of a cinema guy, like... I'm somewhere in between Matt and a normal person.
There is a huge chasm between me and normal
people.
There
certainly is, yeah. To put it in perspective, listeners, before pre-pandemic and now, I guess, kind of post-pandemic, you go five times a week, single week for like 20 years, pretty much?
It'll be three times this week.
There you go, yeah. Three or four times a week, I think, is fairly conservative for you, Mr. Stockton. But yeah, for me, it's a fairly rare thing. I'm more than happy to watch stuff at home a lot of the time, especially now I've moved further out of the city and now going to now I'm out in the suburbs and it's not as easy to just wander around down to the cinema. But that was the thing of, like, I cannot miss this. This is my thing. This is one of my favourite things. This is Villeneuve doing Dune. I need to see it. So yeah, this is the thing that dragged me out of the pandemic kind of... unease of not going to the cinema for a couple of years.
I think for me this is more Villeneuve than the story, because I'm not seeing any of the previous iterations of this on TV or film. But as we know, Villeneuve is probably up there in the number of directors we've had on here, Helen. I think
he's featured a couple of times now. Three.
Second to Quentin Tarantino. So we've had Prisoners, we've had Arrival, we've had Blade Runner, we've had recently Sicario, not sure if that's out yet. And then
I listened to it the other day.
There you go. And so this is, he's up there, and he's a guy that's kind of quietly come along and just made, like, banger after banger, small scale to increasingly larger scale. And when you think Blade Runner 2049, that's one of the biggest films you're ever going to make. And suddenly he's making this three-part space opera thing. And you're just like, well, this is clearly one of the best directors ever. But yeah, it was him that brought me to cinema more than the story. I don't know. What about yourself, Helen? Where did you see this the first time?
So, yeah, I saw this in the cinema. A group of us went. I think there was probably about six of us. We all went at the posh cinema. We went to see it at the Everyman and the big one.
Oh, did you get hot dogs passed to you whilst...
We didn't, but we did see them move along the line. Don't know why they do that. I'm not a huge fan. So, yeah, I saw it at the cinema... rewatched it again, have seen the second one at the cinema. And I think I'm probably going to be the little bit of the outlier. I've never read the books. I have seen the Lynch version, but like years and years and years and years ago. So I kind of went into this thinking, I'm going to have to see it because why wouldn't you? And I'm going to have to see it at the cinema because you'd kind of be a bit crazy not to. Sorry, Tim.
Just called you out there, Tim.
And like the world building is incredible. And there's a couple of members of the cast that I absolutely love in this. Big Oscar Isaacs fan. Dave Bautista, I think, is really, really great in this. And I really love Rebecca Ferguson. However, watching it the second time, I think I kind of got a little bit more of the story and things kind of clicked into place. And I wished I'd have rewatched this before watching part two. But anyway, that's my fault. But I don't know. I just don't really care about Paul that much.
I'm not saying anything. That's kind of the point.
Yeah.
There's like a lot of sand, and I just it didn't.
There's more sand in the second one.
It's too much sand.
It didn't. It's
four
not,
out of five.
Not,
lots of sand. Helen from Flixwatch.
It's not converted me. I went in going, will the magic of Denny be able to kind of convert me and bring me into this world? And it was impressive, and the score is incredible, and like the costume design is great, and how he's brought some of the machinery to life, and like the acting is good, but it just didn't. I was a bit like, well, that's that.
And is this more on the smaller screen than versus the big screen?
No, this is the big screen as well.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, I wonder if it's, I haven't really met any kind of like female fans who've like read the books and they love it and they've kind of gone into it. All of my female film friends who've seen it, we've all been a little bit the kind of same in that we've gone, yeah, it looks really great and it's really well directed and like, yeah. And I don't know whether it's having that real connection with the source material to be able to have kind of your visions brought to life in a way that really kind of reflects it, and in a way that's done in a way that isn't kind of like weird in a David Lynch fan.
How readable is the book, guys? Because it's one of those books I look at and think, oh, that's too thick. That's too much.
That's what I was going to bring up, because I think this is an interesting point, because I, like Jack, wrote it when I was a teenager, and I thought, oh, typical stupid little white kid I was like, it's another white kid protagonist, he's like me. And then like, oh god, as the book goes on, he's a monster. Am I a monster? I'm probably a monster. And it's a good point that Helen raises, because this is kind of like Blade Runner as well, which is a thing that bounces off a lot of people, and women especially. And that's not like, oh, you don't understand it. Nothing to do with that at all. It's entirely to do with this being a 60s book and the way it's written, and it's dense. It's a, even if you like love the movies and think, I'll go read the books now, it's a hard one to get into. It's a lot of internal thoughts, a lot of prose that really throws people off. And I think it's one of those films that, as far as a movie goes, that people appreciate the construction of, but it either clicks with you or it doesn't. And maybe over time it grinds you down and it, you know, you come back to appreciate it, but ultimately some people just go, nah, not for me. I can see why it's great, but I get that.
Should films grind you down? That sounds horrific.
Yes, absolutely. All films are like friendships. Sometimes they just click, and sometimes you have to just get used to them, and then they don't go away, and you think, ah, we should do a podcast, and then there's two of them with you all the time.
You'll never get rid of us, Matthew.
I'm more on Helen's side, to be honest with you. I think as a cinematic experience, this is like, is up there. It's fantastic. But when I was sat down to watch this now, I was like, when I watched it earlier, a couple of days ago, I was like, it looks good, it looks very nice. But I think, to your point, Helen, with these kind of chosen one narratives, often the main chosen person is the least interesting. I'm looking at Harry Potter here, I'm looking at Luke Skywalker. Get to the other people, get to Hermione, get to C-3PO, you know? They're the ones.
Those are your choices, Kobe? Hermione and C-3PO, guys. I was waiting for Han Solo or like, you know, Dumbledore or Snape or somebody cool. No, you're a C-3PO dude.
All about people with really crisp enunciation.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah.
I was trying to think of any female-led chosen one. I think the closest one I could think of is The Hunger Games.
Yeah.
Started off good and went...
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
I haven't read Dune, but I did go in with a fair amount of like knowledge of what happened in it.
Did you watch a YouTube explain it all?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Several.
Sorry, what is Kwisak Haderach?
Yeah.
By the way, subtitles is one of the best things about Netflix.
Yes, yeah. But I think it's one of those things where it is a critique of kind of chosen one narratives. But I think that doesn't really come into play until part two as much, certainly. And I think we sort of called part two a sequel. Really, it's the second half of a single film.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably the only thing, to my mind, that lets down Dune, is that it's an incomplete story. And I think it's a really tricky one to do because, again, not having read the book, but knowing about it, so much of the stuff is kind of about interiority and philosophy and characters explaining how they're thinking through stuff. And I think that Villeneuve does an excellent job of like externalizing a lot of that, but I think you're always going to lose that in that transition from book to film, and I think that will leave you maybe a little bit cold to Paul. I think that's totally understandable because you're just not as entrenched in his sort of personality, and he's quite a... You know, certainly for the first half of the story, which is this film, he's quite a reactive character. And in fact, you know, it's almost like his sort of heel turn is when he becomes someone who is taking actions and sort of taking control of his destiny. When he starts doing that, you're like, oh no, don't do that. that's really bad. No, don't start doing that.
Don't start a space war, Paul. Come on.
Don't start a space war. It's almost like his whole journey is you wanting him to stay away from this stuff. And the first film, the first half of the film, this Dune, it's just him running away from situations almost.
And running away from his destiny as well.
Running away from his destiny. And I think that that, while that is, it does make for some really interesting stuff, especially when you bring part two into it, I think it is half a film. And as much as the visual spectacle of it, the world building is already interesting and the performances are great, you know, and they do their best to make it a unit.
We've talked about the half a film, or you said it a couple of times, and it's been leveled against this and also Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. But I think obviously the nadir of these was the Twilight series and Hunger Games and Harry Potter.
Part six, part but, one. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I don't think in this one, I wasn't so fussed, A, because I didn't know the story, so I didn't know where part one would finish and part two would start. So maybe that's to my advantage. But also that a lot does happen in this film. You feel like you've had a good meal when you've got to the end of it. Enough people die, enough people survive, and you're introduced to people who you're going to meet in the next part of it. For me, I was like, okay, I can see there's a continuation here.
I think a lot of that comes from Villeneuve himself, because much like Peter Jackson with Lord of the Rings, he understands the soul of the book. And so he changes things and he shuffles things around, includes certain things, dips things out. And it's very much a kill your darling situation of like, I know people who like the book want to see this, but we don't need that. So what you end up with is part one is actually a three-act structure that works. It does end in a... And I remember in my review, I wrote, for me, this is a 5 out of 5 film. I love it. It's fantastic. It's such a great adaptation of the source material. But if it ends here and Warner Brothers is stupid enough not to greenlight a sequel, it has to come down in that estimation because it's incomplete. It has a sense of a close, but it doesn't feel like it's actually there. And the interesting thing about Dune as a book and a film and all those things is that until Dune Messiah as a book and Dune Part 3 hopefully as a film, that's where it all comes to sort of a conclusion and fruition that makes sense. It's like, oh God, now I understand, because Villeneuve has gone through and added, he's enhanced characters in certain places to really accentuate the central thesis, which is the Messiah complex, the white savior, this chosen one is a terrible, terrible thing, and it's never going to work. And it's also a key manipulation from politics and genetics and all kinds of things. And it's and he's like whole and he struggles with this. His father talks to him, Oscar Isaac will talk about it and say things like, I just want to be a pilot, but I'm called to lead. And it's like, you don't have to lead. Oddly enough, you don't have to be in charge. You don't have to take control of this planet. You don't have to do all these things. It's like, well, I do. It's like, no, you don't. Colonizing is bad. And the fact that I'm not giving away anything about Dune Part 2, but there's so many reactions to Part 2 in terms of like on TikTok and social media. People go, oh, pull this, pull that. It's like, you are going to have such a fall when we have more of the character revelation come yeah. through, because he is meant to be the worst person. When Herbert wrote the books, it was about Nixon and Kennedy and how they're both enigmatic in different ways and terrible people.
Yes, this was Herbert commenting on the charismatic leader thing. It was like, don't trust charismatic leaders is his entire thesis. And people got caught up in the Paul thing, much as people have now with the films, being like, oh, Paul's the hero, Paul's the best, yeah. I want to cosplay as Paul, dress up him as Halloween or whatever. And Herbert specifically changed how he wrote Messiah and added the subtitle of Messiah to, again, no spoilers, to recontextualize Paul and be like, hey guys, stop idolizing the colonizing warlord. He's the bad guy. I know he's the perspective character, but that is the point. You need to understand this. And Herbert was like, oh God, everybody's idolizing the guy I've built up as the bad guy. We need to reestablish it. And I think you get, again, like you said, Matt, credit to Villeneuve. He sets up so much of that in the first movie. Whereas the book, if you're reading it for the first time, is a much slower, slower build. I don't know. This film can be pretty slow as well, so put that into context. And yeah, I think the way that they're going to kind of round things off, fingers crossed, hopefully, as you said, Matt, hopefully we get the third piece of the trilogy here and we get the conclusion and kind of wrap up of Paul's story. And the way, again, no spoilers for Dune Part 2, there are bigger changes in Part 2 than there are in Part 1 compared to the books. Characters are changed and given more agency. Funnily enough, more female characters have more to do. Yay! Like, we actually get women with lines of dialogue that aren't Jessica in the second movie, which is great. And I think that's a nice kind of shift away from, you know, what worked in the 60s doesn't work in the 2020s. And Villeneuve and the team have done a brilliant job of taking that original kind of thing. Because I know Villeneuve is as much of a Dune nerd, if not more of a Dune nerd than I am. Like, this was his favourite book growing up, and this has been his dream project for decades. He's like, oh, if I get to do one thing, it's going to be Dune. And here he is doing, like, his life's work, essentially.
I heard when he had, like, a little sideline chat with Hans Zimmer and said, have you read the book Dune? And Hans Zimmer was like, fuck yeah, man.
Direct quote from Hans Zimmer there. Yeah.
But two things I want to mention, I don't know how quickly they are, maybe we take them into the scores before we go to the scores though, is first of all, the cinematographer, Greg, I'm not sure if you said Greg or Greg Fraser.
Greg Fraser, yep.
He's another one that's been a slow burner for me, and Denis Villeneuve had Deakins for 2049.
The man. And, the man.
You know, that's beautiful. I can't remember who he's had previously, but all his films have had, well, his films since Arrival certainly have had a fantastic view over them. But Greg Fraser, looking at back at his filmography, The Creator looked awesome recently. Matt Reeves' Batman, fantastic.
Yep.
Star Wars Rogue One, my favourite of the recent era of Star Wars films. Zero Dark Thirty looked great as well. Killing Them Softly was an understated, beautiful film as well. So he's bringing along with him people who are kind of building up at the same rate as him, because the step in even though looking at his back catalogue there, the step up to Dune is huge. Even though he's done Star Wars, that was still kind of, you know, Rogue One, that was an understated one. But this is like the scope, the size of the screen, what we're trying to do and transmit here is massive. So I'm definitely going to be looking out for this guy going forward. And the second thing is just to, less, I don't know anything to add to that, but also just I'm looking at Villeneuve's filmography as well. God damn, this guy is an exciting tour de force, really. Just
the boy don't miss. The man don't miss. Villeneuve's the man. Yeah. I think it was something you said in the Blade Runner 2049 episode, Helen, where you were talking about how this is Villeneuve's kind of almost like feels like his pitch to do Dune, because obviously you guys were watching it in the context of the first part of Dune, what we're talking about on this episode had come out. And I think you're totally right, like bringing the incredible visual style of 2049 and, like you said, Kobe, working with, in my opinion, the greatest living director of photography, Robert Deakins, like having Deakins come through and be just incredible. And now Fraser like stepping up to the plate, and the Batman is so incredibly good looking. The Creator, yes, amazing looking. Both of these Dune movies are spectacular. Rogue One again, like he's turning into the like sci-fi dude. And the fact that The Creator was done on such a short, relatively short filming time, low budget compared to these enormous biggest film in the world Dune type stuff, where you've basically got all the money and all the filming time you could possibly need. And I love the way, you know, he can adapt his style to work with Reeves, to, you know, Gareth Edwards on Rogue One, like stuff like that. Huge credit to Fraser. And as you mentioned, Hans Zimmer just killing it. I know there was an interview with Villeneuve and he was talking about working with Hans, and Hans was like, oh, I'm just going to keep making music and assume we get a part two. And yeah. I was like, no, it's not greenlit. Don't waste your time doing anything. He's like, well, here's like three albums worth of stuff I've done for Dune Part 2 already. So I just carried on working for like another 18 months because I love working with Denis and he's a huge Dune fan, as you said, Kobe. Direct quote, oh, fuck yeah, from Hans Zimmer. So it's like, yeah, it's clear that a lot of the, at least the high level key players who are driving this project from a visual standpoint, from a writing standpoint, from a musical standpoint, really, really give a shit about this. And I think that shows so truly in what we got on the big screen and now on the little screen on Netflix.
And yeah, any comments on just Villeneuve, anything else to add to that, guys, before scores wise?
I mean, I would just say, like, I mean, I'm likewise praying we get a part three to cover Messiah. I think that would be, you know, just the cap off the story and really complete it. You don't want to go into the weirder sort of chapter house Dune and stuff like that, where it's all Messiah sex cults and but I'm really fascinated to see what Villeneuve does after this. Like, yes, is he going to do something more small scale and go back to something like Prisoners, and
which was also Roger Deakins. Sicario Deakins.
It's amazing.
and I'm he is one of the best working today, and I'm so interested to see, you know, given that this was like a dream project for him, where do you go after that? So yeah, a filmmaker that can do no wrong.
The only thing I'll add to that is literally that I wouldn't even say a bad Villeneuve's weakest film is better than most people's strongest films.
And on that...
Yeah. With that, let's head to the scores.
I'm Sam Clements, host of the 90 Minutes or Less Film Festival, another podcast in the Stripped Media family, a podcast that celebrates movies under 90 minutes long. Each episode, I'm joined by a special guest who selects a movie to join our prestigious lineup. Past guests have included fellow Stripped Media family members Martin and Sam from Song by Song, and Kobe from Flixwatcher, and Dave from The Wire Stripped. Search for us now on the app you're currently listening to this podcast, or join us at 90minfilmfest.com.
So welcome to the patented Flixwatcher scores. All of the scores are out of 5. You can have decimal places if you wish, and we will start with you, please, Jack, with your recommendability.
I am kicking things off with a big old 5. Of course I am. I know this is kind of the obvious choice here. It is one of my favourite films of the last few years. If this trilogy pulls it off, this might, like, this has a potential to unseat Lord of the Rings as my greatest trilogy in cinematic history kind of thing. And we'll get on to repeat viewing scores in a minute, obviously. But, like, the fact that I go back and watch the Lord of the Rings films so much, and they have so much, even the fact that that's a, you know, 14-hour experience at this point, and the same is going to be true for the Dune trilogy. Just this part one, I have watched multiple times, and that is not something I typically do. Because I'm a Dune nerd, and because I love this world so much, and I love all the weird little bits, like, anybody wants to tweet at us and discuss the weird spider monster thing that's not explained, please hit me up, because that is so deep in the lore. They're like, oh my god. Yeah, I have to recommend it hugely, and I think it is one of the big things that is pushing cinema forward in terms of visuals, in terms of storytelling, in terms of these huge, big-budget sci-fi things where it's not just for show. As much as I like The Crater, which I also watched recently, like, it's kind of a lot of visuals and not actually much to say, it feels like. I think this has a lot to say, and again, if you know the context and start digging into it, I think it can really, really resonate as a story going forward. So, yeah, huge recommendation, and a 5 from me.
Matt?
I'm going to say 4, and this is a tricky one because I agree with Jack entirely. I think everyone should watch this because it is pushing cinema forward. I think it's challenging, but in a way that Villeneuve makes these sort of what can be considered impossible and ostracizing ideas quite mainstream and palatable. And that's sort of showing in the box office for part 2, which is still going, and yet currently is highest grossing film of the year. It's like, yeah, it's doing its job. It's also the proto relic for, like, Star Wars and everything else that it copied and has copied it going forth. But it is, however, a tricky one to recommend because it's the first half of a film, it's slow burn, it's high science fiction. In the same way recommending, like, Game of Thrones or Lord of the Rings, if someone says, don't like dragons and don't like fantasy, it's like, all right, fine. If you give this a go, you might like it. And maybe not Game of Thrones because how it ended. But the point is that, yeah, it's a tricky one to recommend. So I want to say 4, but I probably still would try and grind people down and say, you should watch this.
You trying to grind people down with recommendations for films, man?
Grinding!
Surely not.
Tim.
I'm going to split the difference and say 4.5 because I think, yeah, all of the criticisms that Matt said apply. It is big, epic science fiction, which is not everyone's cup of tea. It is kind of a little bit of a dude's film to a certain extent, even though I think the women in it do a great job. They certainly remedy some of that in the second half and by giving Charney a lot more to do than she does in the books. And I think there's certainly some valid criticisms about the fact that, you know, and partially this comes from the books, but you've got a bunch of white main characters and then a bunch of Middle Eastern characters who are secondary and or you know, nameless extras kind of thing. But again, that's kind of part of what Dune is and inherently kind of critique of that. So, but yeah, could I recommend it to every single person on the planet? No, but I think in terms of epic science fiction, it's one of the best examples of its kind. It is up there with stuff like Star Wars, and so many people now are going like, oh, so this is why Luke comes from a desert planet and the Jedi fight with swords. And it's like, yes, it's because George Lucas loved Dune. He loved Dune, he loved samurai films.
And he nicked it all.
And yeah. And he loved World War II fighter films. So yeah, 4.5, because I think there's a few caveats, but it's fantastic.
Helen.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned Lord of the Rings a few times. So, like, I've never read any of the Lord of the Ring books at all. Never had any interest whatsoever. But I really, really, really love the films. Like, went to see the second one, like, twice at cinema. I don't go to cinema to see films more than once, usually. And, like, I've watched them loads as well. And I just, like, think they're just amazing. This is a the more I kind of speak to people who've read the books and they kind of explain the books a little bit more, I kind of like go, oh yeah, I kind of get that a little bit. I feel that having that extra knowledge, you shouldn't have to have that to get fully involved in the characters in it. And I think it is that it feels very much like a part one. I remember getting to watching part one and it ended and I just felt as though the story had got going, and part two, I was like, oh, they're setting up for part three, aren't they? What? I still didn't feel as though I'd got the story and I'd quite understood Paul's arc as well as everyone else. So,
did you feel the same way when you were watching Lord of the Rings for the first time?
No, I was like,
interesting.
Oh my God, this is great. What happens? What happens to the ring? What? I've got to wait a whole year for this. I could read the books. I didn't. Sorry. I just watched the films. So, yeah, it was very, very different. I mean, the stories are different and what they're doing in that.
I mean, that was another where the Chosen One was the least interesting person in the story.
Yeah. Whose favourite character is Frodo? Like, come on.
No one. And, like, even if I come out of a Villeneuve film and feel that maybe it didn't quite connect with me, I still think he's doing something that hardly any other of the directors are doing. So I do think I'm definitely going to see part three because I've kind of got to. Maybe that will kind of then solidify all of the experiences together to give it a bit more. But if someone would say to me, like, oh, should I go and see Dune at the cinema? I haven't seen one yet. Should I watch it? I'd be like, have you had much interest in the books? And if they said no, I'd be like, oh, don't know. So I'm going to give it a 3.5. I think if you've read the books, then obviously you're going to see it and you're going to love it. If like Blade Runner 2040 is your favourite film, you're probably really going to enjoy it. Outside of that, the Venn diagram is, you might struggle a little bit, I think.
So I think for me, a lot of these, I know we have a specific score for that with the small screen score, but a lot of this is going to be coloured by where you're going to watch this the first time. And if the first time you're going to watch it is going to be on your at home at the TV, I think that's going to take it down a few pegs. So I'm going to go for a 3.8 here. And that's partly because in the cinema, it's like, yep, I get it. This is great. Love it. Didn't know anything about it. Had to pick up the thing about the shields, like quick doesn't break it. Slow does penetrate it. Loved that. Didn't know about that before it started. That spider thing, I was like, well, that's a bit freaky. Also, didn't need the bit in it. You had the voice, you had the sign stuff, which I sometimes do to Sarah. She has no idea what I'm doing. I just go like that. And she's like, I don't know what you're doing, Kobe. Neither do I. It doesn't matter. So, yeah, for the cinema experience, it'd be higher. If you're watching it on Netflix, then it's going to be lower. So averaging out like 3.8. Repeat viewing score. Jack, well, I can guess where this is going to be.
That is an inclusion of fives, isn't it?
we'll get to the small screen score in a minute because we've already all talked about that element so far. So
sure.
Yeah, that'll be the next section. But repeat viewing, yeah, I think this is something, you're totally right, Helen. I think it is so dense at times. And I think this is a part of storytelling that I really like, but I think a lot of people really don't like. And it's because I'm coming in with that context of, they do a lot of show, don't tell. I use the spider monster as kind of a joke there of like, if you don't know, and I still don't know, and I've read six of the bloody books, like, is that thing that I think it is? Like, the implication is that is Dr. Yue's wife, the Harkonnens and the Bene Gesserit have, like, experimented with, and he's like, oh, you can meet your wife now before he kills her, before Harkonnen kills the doctor, because she's been dead for a long time and all that kind of stuff. There's a potential implementation there. There's also hinting at wider lore stuff of like other crazy psychic space nun stuff called the Tlelaxu, which is a whole other thing I won't get into. But there's loads of like bits and pieces I think you can pick up on repeat viewings, and it's something I definitely plan on going back to. You mentioned, Helen, like, oh, I wish I'd gone back and watched part one for part two. You better believe I'm watching part one and part two ready for part three. So, bias, I think, in many ways, because it is one of my favourite things, and growing up with the book and having all the full context and stuff. But it is 3 hours long nearly, and that is a big commitment. So I'm going to be, you know, going to be kind of like sensible about this. I'm going to go 4.5 with my repeat viewing score.
Sensible. Matt?
This is going to come up again when we talk about engagement, but I'll try and keep it synced to this specifically. Repeat viewing, I'm going to give a 4.5 because I think going into part two, to sort of misquote Helen there, you kind of need to see part one again. So, and when part three comes out, you're going to have to see part one again because it is dense, because you think, who's this? What faction is this? What's going on?
But Matt, there's so many YouTube channels that do 5-minute recaps where you just watch that. You don't need to watch full movies. Just watch a
full
story in 60 seconds. Watch a TikTok. You'll be fine.
No. Watch
Cinema is dead.
No. God, I'm grinding my knuckles. I'm going to stop doing that. Just like cracking. Like, shut up, Jack. No. But I do think that the other thing as well is that, to me, this is the kind of film that quietly seeps into your mind and you think about it more and more over time. Now, some people will go, not me, I didn't like it, and it bounced off it, and that's perfectly fine, nothing wrong with that at all. But if you have a sort of, if it piqued your interest a bit and you saw it and thought, oh yeah, I kind of enjoyed that, I like the scope of it all, and then you start thinking more about it, more back about it, maybe I'll go give it a go again. And I think it's kind of essential repeat viewing when you're going for sequels. Now, when all three are out and, you know, you've seen them all, will anyone watch them again all in total who hasn't really become a mega fan? Don't know. But at this point, part one is essential repeat viewing, so I'm going to say 4.5.
Tim?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much echoing the other guys here, I think there's so much kind of density of information here that is touched on, that is dealt with in a way that is really, you are told what you need to do, and then there is a bunch of stuff that's left unsaid that you can kind of imply from, or you can go out and watch a bunch of YouTube videos, or you can, you know, God, if you're insane, you could read a Dune book.
Oh, Tim, let's not go too far.
But I think, you know, it does a very good job of leaving a lot unsaid that you can then think about afterwards, and you can rewatch and get deeper things from. So I will also say a 4.5 because I think there's a lot to pick up from on subsequent viewings.
Helen?
Yeah, I think you need to see it more than once to kind of get what's going on. But yeah, the runtime is off-putting, so you've kind of got to weigh up how much you want to get out of it and how much time you have to do it. So I definitely felt I got a lot more on the rewatch, so I'm going to give it a 4.
I'm going to have 3.82 here because, yeah, and yes, I didn't rewatch this before watching Dune 2. I don't think I was lost, but I think because I maintained kind of the key plot points. But going back to it after seeing Dune 2, I was like, oh, there's lots of things I'd kind of missed, like Skarsgård's character. I'd forgotten what happened to him and how he'd manifested in this life. So it's something I'll definitely try and watch part one and two again before three. But outside of preparing and studying for part three, how often I'll watch it again, them again, I don't know. I just don't know.
You got the homework there, Gary, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Gonna eat all that broccoli before having the pudding. So, did I say 3.8? I can't remember.
You said 3.8.
3.8.2.
Like,
oh, God. I didn't know you could do
that. That was so
grand. Point decimal places, mate.
You can
God.
Do whatever you want, guys. Adam Buxton,
as pie.
Adam Buxton did pick pie. One score.
Yeah.
Small screen score. Oh, interesting. Interesting. Jack.
This is the big one, right? This is the one we basically all mentioned it already on the episode. And this is like I'm just going to give it fives across the board. It's like, I can't do that for this because it is such a cinematic experience that is, as you said earlier, Kobe, like, it matters where you see this film and what context you see it in. And because we're recommending on this podcast, and this podcast is called Flix Watcher because we're talking about Netflix films, the listeners are going to watch it on Netflix if they haven't already. So, yeah, I think it is genuinely like lessens the experience by not experiencing it in the biggest screen with the best sound possible and the most comfortable seats and whatever snack of choice where you got that incredibly gross popcorn bucket or whatever you need. Like, it is harmed by that experience. having watched it a few times now, I feel like I could get away with like watching it on a laptop or, God forbid, a phone or something. But that's because I'm just like tuned in enough that I can kind of have it on in the background kind of thing. But that would be not the same as watching it for the first time. For the first time, and even for the second time, I think you do need to see it on the biggest screen possible, whether that's your big home screen or the cinema. So
the cinema. Unless you have the cinema as your home screen, then...
Yeah, unless you've got a home cinema. One of my buddies in America has like a full... It was his prerequisite when him and his wife moved in. It was like, I am getting a home cinema room. And it's just like six actual cinema chairs and the biggest projector screen you've ever seen in your life. And I'm like, I am so jealous. That's so cool. And he hooks his PlayStation up to it. I'm like, oh, that's the coolest thing in the world. Anyway, I think it is genuinely harmed by being on the small screen. It is not the same experience. So I'm going to have to go for a 3, unfortunately.
I'm a buck the trend like a mental here. You ready for this?
I watched it on a phone and I love it.
5.
What?
Now hear
what?
Me out. As both what? A director and a critic, I'm going to talk about this. So basically, I saw Saving Private Ryan in the cinema. I know it's a tangent, bear with me. And it's like, oh my God, there's so much going on and it's so chaotic. And I feel like I'm on the beach and oh, this, I'm being drawn in by these people. I'm taken through the whole theatre of France and this war. Oh my God, this is so much. And you watch it on the TV or same with Gravity. You go, I've kind of lost something here. It's not the same thing. But the reality is if you're watching something like Save It Private Ryan or Gravity, your only way to watch it really is on your television, tablet, phone, wherever I'm to be. Now, the difference is Greg Fraser and Denis Villeneuve have directed this in a very specific way, and it's composed in a very specific way with big open spaces and the camera sweeps in certain ways that everything looks and feels big no matter the screen you're watching on. So of course cinema is the best way to watch this. You're engrossed, you're immersed, and if you have a big TV or a big monitor, whatever it happens to be, if you're watching on a computer, yes, you will get a great experience from it. But the truth is, you can see everything you need to see. You can see the scale where it needs to be seen, you can see bombs being dropped on the ships, and it gives you the close-ups where you need them. It gives you the scope of the madness in the dark as people are running around and the Sada car are coming in and all that sort of stuff. I've got a 55-inch 4K TV and I go, oh, this is huge. If I sit close enough, it's like IMAX. But I've also watched it on my phone. And I mean that in the sense of like, I've been going somewhere and watching clips and it still holds up in the sense of that scale. You can still tell how big it is. Same with like Blade Runner 2049. You get that sense of space because of the way the shot composition works. So as silly as it sounds, yes, of course, cinema is 100% the best way to watch it. But if that isn't an option, you will still have a phenomenal visual experience. So 5.
Oh, I'll take that 5, Matt. Appreciate it. You're with the outlier here, I think, but I appreciate it nonetheless.
Tim?
As someone who watched it for the first time at home, I did at least make the effort to watch it on my big TV rather than on the laptop, even though it would have meant I could watch it in bed, which, you know, is always the preferable experience.
Just what Greg Fraser wanted.
Yeah.
Drowsy and in bed.
I think it does. I think seeing it in the cinema, if I get the chance, I'm absolutely going to take leap at it because the scale of it is something to be experienced. I think Matt has got a good point about how it is shot in a very clear way. You know, it is not a particularly like shaky cam type viewing where you're going to lose clarity on stuff. But I still think that it would gain so much. And having seen part two in the cinema and experienced that and the overwhelming nature and the score as well, like the sound of it is never going to be as good as in the cinema. So I'm going to go 3.5.
Helen?
Yeah, I'm also going to go 3.5. I mean, preferable, obviously, your first time to watch it in the cinema. And I think it does obviously lose some of that grandness, but, you know, you can kind of maybe focus in on some of the other details. Like for this time I was able to like make myself some notes and things, which I couldn't really do in the cinema. And like I noted a line where I can't remember her name, but she says, so much potential is wasted in a male, which I quite liked, and I saved that one. I'm gonna keep that one to throw it out every now and again. So
you should go on Etsy and get like a print of that quote.
Yeah, some t-shirts.
Oh, if you type Dune into Etsy, you're gonna have a good time, my friend, don't you worry.
That sounds so dodgy. That sounds like...
There's loads of cool stuff is what I meant, okay, Kobe. Yeah. It's very quotable. It's very cool, all right?
Jack is tracking down stuff. These bootleg popcorn buckets for uses.
Sorry, Helen.
So, yeah, 3.5.
I'm going to go low. I'm going to go for 3. In the cinema, enveloped me, sound, visuals, engagement, super high. Maybe just this on this rewatch, I was just a bit more tired. I was just like, I'd seen Dune 2 a few days before, and I thought, oh, that's almost, I just need to rewatch it again for this pod. Maybe it felt a bit more like a chore than like anything. Well, but I think a lot of that
sorry to bring you a chore, Kirby. Wow.
But I think a lot of that was due to the experience on the small screen versus the bigger screen. So 3, in that case, engagement score, Jack.
You know it's going to be a 5, baby, straight in there. From the opening line that is said in a different language on white text on a black screen, the dreams are messages from the deep in the Sardaukar, like throat singing language, melted my brain that Villeneuve was going that hard and that weird just straight off the bat. It grabbed my attention straight away. And again, I think that's me being super nerdy about the Dune side of things. And no spoilers for Dune Part 2, but he does it again in Dune Part 2. I don't know. Before we walked into the cinema, Matt and I were like, is he going to do the thing again? Is he going to open with a like throat singing thing? Is it going to be something cool and weird? It was. He does it again and it's even better. And it just grabs your imagination straight away. And I think as much as it is a slow build, the amount of stuff that it leaves you questioning, like just the handover of Arrakis and all the like ceremony and ritual and procedure and stuff that is built in with Oscar Isaac's like underrated performance, in my opinion, as Leto Atreides, like having to be all super formal and still very uncomfortable at the same time, and going through that whole process, seeing Caladan and how so polar opposite it is to Arrakis and all that kind of stuff. And once we're on Arrakis, we are absolutely going for it, and there is all loads of weird, cool stuff happening. Whether it's the spice harvesters, or Jessica going on weird spiritual journeys, or Paul's dreams and hallucinations and stuff, I think it's absolutely captivating cinema from start to finish.
Matt,
I'm gonna again maybe pull another surprise out of the rug. I'm gonna say 3.5. Now, I'm saying that, yeah, Jack's already fallen off his seat. Now, the reason is because I'm trying to be semi-dispassionately.
Did you get this around the wrong way with the small screen experience? Have you got the numbers wrong?
No. Because specifically, I'm a fan of the book and I'm engaged because I'm already sold, because I already have a story and I'm already waiting to see what happens. I've seen the TV adaptation, I've seen the Lynch adaptation, etc., etc. But if you are new to this and you haven't got that context, and we talk about certain things where you're like, oh, I watched this film once, or I read the book, and you can bounce off it really easily. Doesn't matter how good it is, how much it looks great, how much it feels interesting and compelling. It is playing with things that are now so tropey and so cliche, because it's eventually trying to turn those cliches on its head. But this is part one of a 3-part story, if not bigger story. So technically speaking, what you end up with is a lot of like, I feel like I've seen this before. I feel like I've done this. I feel like I don't care. I feel you lost me. You can appreciate certain things, but to be engaged, I feel this is very much a whisk becomes a shout, not in a Lynchian boof, where you're just shouting with a little black box. But specifically what I mean by that is, I meant about the repeat viewing, about for a lot of people, this does stick in your brain and think, yeah, I think I liked it. I think it was, I was pretty good. I was right. And then you go back and think about, but how does that work? And how, why do they hate each other? And all this sort of stuff starts to gestate in your mind, and you start to appreciate it more, and etc., etc., etc. I think, weirdly enough, Blade Runner is a fantastic comparison, because the original Blade Runner was the same, where people were just sort of as, it looks good, but I don't know if I like it. And this is what I think Dune is, and over time will be appreciated more and more and become a bit of a classic. But ultimately, a knee-jerk reaction can be very clearly, nope, not for me. And part of that is the pacing, the presentation, the story, the tropes, etc. So 3.5.
Tim.
Yeah, I think in terms of getting its hooks into you and sort of just forcing you to follow through on it, I think it does have to do a bit of work, because it is a, you know, for people who don't know the books, who maybe science fiction isn't their favourite genre of choice, there is a lot going on here, you know, and you really have to be the kind of person who is willing to just kind of go in and go, okay, yeah, I will absorb all of this. And I think it's 3 hours long, you know, and you're getting half a story. So there is definitely that to factor in. And I think to kind of think of the flicking through TV test, I think if I came across it, I would definitely watch it for a while and maybe get to certain scenes. But it's a big commitment to be like, okay, yeah, oh, we're near the beginning. Oh, great. I'll watch that. Oh, okay. Yeah, no. Okay. Looking at your watch and kind of realizing what time it is. But I think there is a certain compelling nature to it, almost like it's using the voice that will keep you on track with it. And I think this first part, this first film, is a tragedy. It is about this, the fall of the House of Atreides. And I think that there is definitely, when it's so clearly set up, when they, within the first half an hour of the film, you've got Oscar Isaac being like, we're walking into a trap. And then, of course, you want to see the trap close. So I'm going to say a 4.
Helen?
Yeah, I'm going to go with 3.5 on this one. So even though I really was like, come on, let's be focused and not end up poking around on Wikipedia and
wake up.
Then going as far as to read like the cliff notes. So I really got into that for a little bit. And then I was like, oh shit, I should be watching this. I really struggled to have the engagement watching it at home just because there was too much distraction. And I was a bit like, oh, so who's that gang? Gang, not the Cord family, what they call them?
Houses.
Harkonnens.
No, they're like the houses. So all the different houses. So I was trying to like work out how many houses there were and who was in what house and why is there bagpipes? And yeah, so well, obviously in the cinema, I couldn't do that. So I had much more engagement focus, even if I was a bit like, get to the action going. So yeah, a little bit low for me.
I'll join you on 3.5. I've talked about this is the home viewing experience and taking more into it versus the cinematic experience. And that gives an overall score of 3.98100. So just a whisker.
That's small underneath. Screen score, isn't it?
Yeah, small screen score is taking it down a peg or two. Guys, do follow us if you're listening, as you're listening to us. If you don't follow us already on Twitter or Instagram, we are on Twitter at FlixWatcherPod and on Instagram at FlixWatcher. And do follow us because we do ask for your opinions before we go into recording so you guys can get your voices heard on this show as well. So look out for a tweet saying something similar to, we're reviewing Dune with ELW Chambers, Stogkers and Trivia_Lad from Sequelizers. Have you seen it? Tell us your thoughts and your score out of 5 stars. For an on-air shout-out on FlixWatcher. So we had one response for this, Jack.
We certainly did, yeah. John Loftus says, a sci-fi spectacular from Villeneuve with breathtaking visuals and a career-making role for Chalamet. He is the Kwisatz Haderach. Ferguson, Skarsgård and Batista, all excellent too. I actually prefer it to part 2. 5 worms out of 5.
Nice use of emojis there.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah.
Good emojis.
Good worm emoji usage.
Jack, can you tell us where we can find you guys in the podcast online and we'll say goodbye to the listeners?
We are Sequelizers on absolutely everything. You mentioned Twitter and Instagram there, Kobe. We're on Twitter and Instagram. We are on basically everything you can listen to podcasts on. You can go to sequelizers.com and find our Discord, find our Patreon, all that kind of stuff. Sequelizers is spelled SEQUELISERS. There's no Zs, there's no As, despite the many misspellings we've had over the years. It is all E's and all S's. And yeah, sequelizers.com is links for absolutely everything and a nice little hub to find everything there.
Guys, it's been a pleasure speaking to you about Dune. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thanks so much,
man.
Bye.
Thank you.
Enjoyed this episode of FlixWatcher Podcast? Why not leave us a 5-star review on iTunes? You can also follow us at FlixWatcherPod on Twitter and we're at FlixWatcher on Instagram. Thanks as always to the mighty people for their mighty, mighty tunes and Rockwood Audio's editing skills. If you're looking to get your podcast edited as sweet as this, get in touch with Rockwood, R-O-K-K Wood Audio. Tell them FlixWatcher sent you.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.